Hello, my name is Andrew Pollard. Welcome to our podcast series, The Oxford Colloquy, bringing the facts, stories and people behind the science. Peter Openshaw, CBE, Professor of Experimental Medicine at Imperial College. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So, Peter, today we're going to talk about a virus that you've been working on for many years called RSV. And perhaps we could start by telling us, what is this virus and why should we care about it at all?
It's an extraordinarily important virus, as all pediatricians know. It's really one of the major viruses that infects children during the first year of life and goes on to reinfect children and then reinfect adults throughout life. I think it's more recently been appreciated that it's also very important in older adults. Maybe we'll come on to that later. In terms of what it is, RSV is respiratory syncytial virus. Now, that in itself is quite a mouthful. And I greatly regret that it didn't get called something a little bit, slipped off the tongue a little bit easier when it was first coined. It was first described actually by a group that included a Dr. Savage. And I've said for some years that if it only had been called the Savage agent, history would have been different.
Exactly right. And I guess RSV may turn out to be a name that we become very familiar with in the general public, as we are with influenza or flu. But certainly at the moment, whenever I talk about RSV, there are blank faces around. And in some ways, given that we are today on the verge of potentially being able to control this virus to some extent, it seems a shame that we haven't had better communication for the public. But let me take you back. We first met in the mid-90s, I think, when you were running a lab in Imperial College working on RSV. So how did you get into working with this virus?
Well, actually, I got interested in it, actually, because it causes such intense inflammation in the lungs. And I was really, as an adult chest physician, I was interested in lung inflammation. And I thought working on RSV would be a good way to understand inflammatory lung disease. And I started working on it for my PhD back in 1985 and somehow got rather hooked into it and stayed with it for all these decades. And it's very exciting for those of us in the RSV field to finally see, after all these years, all these studies we've done on the immunology of RSV, that finally we now have a number of different interventions which may help at different stages of life that could possibly greatly reduce the impact of RSV on respiratory health.
So the early work that was being done in your lab on the virus, was that more about trying to understand how it caused the inflammation in the lungs? Or was it more about trying to think about how to make vaccines to prevent it or drugs to treat it?
It was really about trying to understand inflammation. That was what we were interested in. And the way in which we were working on it was tuned to try to induce inflammation using the virus and using maneuvers that you could say were akin to vaccination to increase the severity of that inflammation. You know, there were studies, a number of studies, which were done back in the 1960s, which showed that certain types of vaccine designed to protect against RSV actually caused a dramatic increase in hospitalization rate during subsequent RSV infection, rates climbing from maybe 5% to about 80% of children who were given the vaccine needed hospitalization. It was a terrible set of events. It really, I think, horrified people who were developing vaccines at that time. But for those of us who wanted to understand inflammation, how the immune system causes inflammation, this was a perfect situation in which to investigate, you know, inflammation caused by a known agent, in this case, a virus.
And so as a paediatrician, I'm very familiar with RSV because of the huge numbers of babies that are admitted to hospital every winter. Here in this country, it's between 22 and 30,000 babies admitted every winter, breathless, needing oxygen, some ending up in the intensive care unit. What is it about RSV that is causing such severe inflammation when a baby first meets it, at least in a proportion of infants? And what does that inflammation look like in comparison with other viruses?
Yes, it is a particularly inflammatory virus. It causes a lot of migration of cells out of the blood into the into the lung, particularly around the small airways called bronchioles. So it causes a condition called bronchiolitis. But as you say, it's only in a proportion. It's only about maybe 1 in 40, 1 in 50 babies that has that sort of inflammatory action that leads to hospitalization. I think as an adult chest physician, it's of great interest to us because it also causes inflammation in older adults, particularly in those over 65, and particularly with what we call comorbidities, you know, things like heart failure or pre-existing lung disease. And in those older adults, it's often a completely unappreciated, almost unknown infection because the effects of the infection are quite delayed. They often follow a week or 2 or 3 weeks after the nasal infection, the cold, which has originally resulted in the deterioration. And by that time, the diagnostic tests are often negative. So it's a rather mystery virus in those older adults, but may account for something like a third of the excess winter deaths that are normally ascribed to influenza. So, you know, it's a very, very important virus in causing deaths in older adults, as well as, you know, filling the pediatric wards, the wards that on which you work every winter.
And is there something that the virus is doing that stops us preventing infections in the future? I mean, the worst infections are happening in infants, but then every 3 or 4 years, most adults will still get a cold with RSV. So why don't we have immunity to it? Is it like COVID continually changing so that it can escape our immune system? Or is our immune response just rubbish?
Yes, or like influenza, where the virus is constantly evolving, new types of influenza come in, we have to constantly update the vaccines. So RSV is really interesting. It's not like that. It seems to have ways of turning off the immune response. If you look at the antibody response to RSV, all of us have antibodies, but the antibody levels are boosted by reinfection, but they decline back to your pre-existing level, almost as if the source of antibody has been turned off completely. And the virus, as soon as it gets into cells, starts to produce large amounts of non-structural proteins. In other words, proteins which are not incorporated into the virus, but which have an effect on the cells of tuning down the immune response. So the virus very actively and specifically negates the immune response, which might prevent future infection. So the virus itself does mutate gradually over time, but it's not that mutation that leads to reinfection. It's the ability of the virus to again and again get round the immune system and reinfect.
So that's really very different from what we were just discussing with COVID and with influenza, where it's the high mutation rate. So does RSV just not have as many mistakes when it's making copies of itself?
Well, it does. It does make mistakes. It does evolve gradually. And we've seen some quite significant shifts in the structure of the virus over time, but these don't seem to be the reason for reinfection. The reason for reinfection seems to be that the virus has developed ways of tuning down the immune response so that its future generations can get back in again. Its progeny are given another foothold in the respiratory tract, which allows transmission and future winter outbreaks typically.
So we see, certainly further away from the equator, these, as you say, large winter outbreaks, which usually occur just before the flu season. And really, we see that mostly, and we'll come back to adults in a moment, we see that mostly in infants. Who is it who is bringing the virus back, either into the UK every winter, or specifically into the home infecting babies? Because it's not sitting there waiting for the baby to get infected, presumably.
Yeah, well, I think the finger points at toddlers. So toddlers going to nursery or to preschool, you know, it often seems to be when you look at household studies, it's often the toddler who is first positive in a household, and then it may spread to the infant, and it may spread to other adults, to carers. And often, you know, the adult carers are not particularly sick. They've got a bit of a sniffle, they've got a bit of a cold, and they may go on to transmit as well. But I think, you know, toddlers are really the criminals when it comes to the spreading of this virus, and I think we need to think about how we can prevent that spread? You know, is there some way that we could induce a response in those toddlers, perhaps with a nasal vaccine that might reduce their ability to spread?
So there's even more to the terrible twos than just the tantrums. It's also the infecting all the rest of us with RSV.
That's a very good way of putting it.
So with the older adults who we see coming into hospital, I've been very struck that actually we have so little information in that age group. And I don't know whether this is just a cultural difference, but you know, we test for viruses all the time in children in pediatrics. But in adult practice, my sense is that that hasn't been something which happened internationally, which is perhaps why we have much less understanding of just how important RSV and maybe other viruses are in older adults.
I absolutely agree that, and it's partly a cultural thing. I think it's partly pragmatic, because if somebody comes in with a worsening of their heart or lung disease, and it might be due to a virus, what are you going to do that's different, depending on the result of sophisticated and potentially reasonably expensive tests? I think, you know, that's been the real problem, is that a test doesn't lead to any consequential change in the way that you manage people. So that's one difficulty. I think the other is that the sample that you take, maybe a nasal swab, may be negative at the time that those older adults come in. What you might need are lower airway samples taken at bronchoscopy. You're not really going to be doing bronchoscopy on somebody who's come in with low oxygen levels, who's struggling to breathe, and where the test isn't actually going to change the way in which you manage the patient. So it's the site, it's the time, and it's the consequence of a positive result, all of which conspire to mean that people really aren't testing, and we don't know what impact these vaccines are going to have on future health.
So I think the description you've given of the inflammation in the lungs in older adults sounds very different from in babies, where it's clearly the virus initially infecting the individual and causing a big inflammatory response when they first meet the virus. When we're talking about older adults, they've presumably met the virus certainly many tens of times, if not more than that. And so they have pre-existing immunities. They're not going to get the same disease that a completely naive infant has. So is it more to do with the underlying health conditions? And actually, it doesn't matter what the virus is, that whatever you get, if you've got very bad heart failure, you'll get worse. Or is there something that RSV is doing that's different?
Well, it still is a very inflammatory virus. You know, I think that inflammation does really underpin the effects that we see. I mean, when I went into this field, actually, people were going around saying, you know, it's the virus, stupid. Whenever I said, look, we need to look at the inflammatory immune response, people actually were wearing badges at conference saying, it's the virus, stupid.
Well, and that was directed at you, Peter, wasn't it?
And yes. But I think it is now obvious to most of us that actually it's the inflammatory response which is so important. And it does differ at different ages. You know, babies have a different type of immune response from older adults, but it's still inflammation which is at the root of it. And I think one thing we learned during COVID was that a lot of that inflammation, which is so important, is centered around cells called macrophages. I did my PhD largely on T cells, actually, partly on antibody, but really on T cells. And we sort of knew about macrophages, but didn't really understand much about the sort of immunity that is associated with macrophage activation. But I think those cells are very important in adult RSV disease, and probably also in pediatric RSV disease, but in different ways.
So we have this virus where we've got essentially no treatments today for the virus. We certainly, when people are sick with an RSV infection, it's largely around supportive care, giving them oxygen support in the lungs if they're failing. And why is that? Is the virus particularly difficult to develop new antiviral drugs for? What has been the problem with such a big burden of disease to actually advance therapy against RSV?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that's the key, is what can we use therapeutically? And, you know, if the obvious thing to say would be antivirals, you know, this is triggered by a virus. What we need is an antiviral drug. And I think that logic led to widespread use in the past of a drug called ribavirin, which does have some antiviral effect, but actually very little clinical effect and a lot of drawbacks in its practical use. I think what we've learned by our studies of influenza and of SARS-CoV-2 have been, you know, a message which came out of the RSV field originally, which is that in order to achieve anything with an antiviral drug, you need to intervene very early indeed. And the best way to try to reduce the impact is to do things which lead to protective immunity prior to exposure. In other words, the development of vaccines, or possibly, you know, passive antibody protection with various antibodies that can be injected or infused or delivered in other ways.
So I think, as you say, with the drugs, that if you develop these respiratory viral infections, and there are drugs that can be used for influenza as well, there is good evidence that you can shorten the duration of the illness if you give them very early. But of course, most people don't present to their doctor the day that they first get a sniffle, and they wouldn't know that they have influenza on that day. And as soon as a few days have gone by, presumably because of this inflammation, it's no longer the virus, stupid. It's the inflammation that's
exactly
the problem. So you can't alter that with drugs against the virus.
And I think this was spectacularly well illustrated by studies such as Peter Horby and Martin Landry did during COVID, where they were looking at different types of intervention and again emphasized the importance of timing. You know, the anti-inflammatory treatments that are effective in COVID-19.
Such as steroids,
yes, particularly steroids. You know, they work if you give them at the right time. In other words, when the inflammation has developed, not during the very early phase when there's a lot of virus around, but later on. And I think that may be a general lesson that we need to apply to future trials of how to modulate the severity of inflammation in other conditions like RSV-induced lung disease, is that we need to, you know, wait for the right moment for the right drug, and that modulating inflammation may be a very good way to deliver treatment, but it has to be at the right time and with the right agent matched to the inflammation which is going on in the lung at the time.
So perhaps with older adults with RSV-associated lung problems, where it's later and more likely to be inflammatory rather than the virus, that might be more useful. Perhaps with infants where they have a lot of inflammation right from the early on in the infection, it might be less useful.
Yes, and it might be a different intervention. I think, you know, by looking carefully at the type of inflammation and matching the drug to the disease and to the timing of that disease, that might be the way forward in those who slip past the defences that we can now offer with vaccines and with passive antibody.
So you've mentioned these two new interventions. It feels like we're on the cusp of actually seeing whether they work in real populations. There are trials now, both the vaccines given either to older adults before the RSV season, or indeed to pregnant women, so that their newborns are protected by the transfer of antibody from the mother across the placenta before birth to protect the baby from RSV when the season arrives. So that's vaccines, and then the antibodies can be given to the newborn and protect the baby through certainly the first 6 months of life from the trials. So what sort of data are there around these interventions, and should we really be very hopeful about them?
I think we should be so hopeful. I mean, it makes me grin from ear to ear to think just how effective the trials show these interventions to be. I never thought that I would see a vaccine that is able to protect around 80% of the serious consequences of RSV in older adults. And those vaccines would be the first that we see coming through into clinical practice. But, you know, that's the sort of level of protection against lower respiratory tract consequences that we're seeing from these vaccines. And there are a couple of those now which are approved and which look roughly equally protective. I mean, I think we should acknowledge that, you know, it's not easy to make these vaccines, and that actually one manufacturer got right up to doing large-scale clinical trials and then terminated and pulled out for reasons that we're not exactly sure of. But, you know, it's been a long, hard road.
Yes, I looked at the vaccine development portfolio a few years ago, and I saw there were 60 different products in development, and there won't be many that get to the final hurdle, but it just shows what an important area this is seen as by some, certainly the pharmaceutical industry.
I think, yes, it's one of the last big ones against which we think it is going to be relatively feasible to make vaccines. It is one of the remaining big infections that cause major disease, for which vaccines, I think, are now finally going to be available.
And certainly in paediatrics, if you stop RSV infections, I mean, that transforms what hospitals do.
Yes.
It's a large part of the burden through the winter. So just coming back to the early life part of this, if you vaccinate the mother or give a monoclonal to the newborn, what are the particular challenges immunologically in doing that for getting protection for those infants?
Yes, so I mean, maternal vaccination is very important because it potentially offers a relatively cheap way in which we might be able to protect large numbers of infants worldwide, not just in developed countries. And it might be possible for the price of a single dose of vaccine to protect, you know, a high proportion of infants in developing countries where the mortality from RSV disease seems to be particularly severe. So, you know, maternal vaccination would be great.
So the maternal vaccines have huge promise as a way of trying to prevent infection in the first months of life because of transfer of antibody from the mother across the placenta. How good did they look in protection terms?
Really, really promising. I was very excited to see the early data that came out of the maternal vaccination studies. And of course, you know, bear in mind that the most severe disease that is seen is in infants during the first 3 months of life. So that's exactly the age group that would be protected by maternal vaccination. The other approach, which you mentioned, is giving the baby a shot of antibody. And this has been feasible for quite a few years now in the form of injections which are repeated once a month. They're quite expensive. They're limited in use to those at highest risk. And that means a lot of babies who are not deemed at high risk actually do end up getting into hospital with RSV disease because they weren't targeted with the antibody. Now, this longer acting antibody, which has been created by laboratory modification, which lasts for a good 5 months or so, means that with a single shot, you can protect babies through their first RSV season at a time when their lungs are still quite small and developing and particularly vulnerable. And I think that that's very exciting. If the price of that antibody is low enough, you can imagine that actually you could give it to all infants during their first RSV season. And that could have a real impact, not only on immediate consequences of infection, but possibly also in terms of longer-term respiratory health in those babies.
So a couple of things to pick up on there. One is the point you made earlier about that huge burden that there is in low-income settings, where RSV is a killer of babies, one of the most important causes of death in the first year of life. Fortunately, in high-income settings, it's a relatively rare cause of death, but it's a huge cause of hospitalization. And I think the other area that is worth thinking about is your perhaps throwaway comment about the future of respiratory health if you do prevent severe RSV. So what did you mean by that?
Well, so as an adult physician who's looked after a lot of patients with asthma and with recurrent wheeze, it's always puzzled me, you know, why is it that some people develop asthma and others don't? And there were some really very extraordinary studies done many years ago, and you know, studies continue to emerge showing the same sort of thing, which is that babies who've been admitted with bronchiolitis, who have severe RSV infection, go on to have a high risk of being diagnosed with asthma and of developing recurrent wheeze. And that risk, according to different studies, you can see increase in those rates for maybe 6 to 13 years. So it could be that during a long period of childhood, babies who have been in hospital with bronchiolitis suffer from recurrent health problems. I mean, you know, I myself actually hope this isn't oversharing, but when I was a young child, I had a severe episode of bronchiolitis, and I missed something like 1 week in 4 of schooling up until the age of about 12. So I was often at home wheezing, and in those days with very few drugs that could treat my asthma. And I've always wondered if I would have been a much healthier person if only RSV had been prevented or delayed in those early years and I hadn't had that episode of illness. So I think, you know, finally, we potentially are going to have the tools to resolve that question. You know, what will happen if we delay or prevent RSV during that early window of childhood? Will we suddenly have a whole lot of children who are much healthier? And that would be fantastic. But we have the tools to resolve that.
Yeah, so I mean, there are some, I think, very clear epidemiological studies which show an association between having severe RSV and then childhood wheeze and asthma. But the jury is out on whether if you prevent those infections, you'll actually prevent those long-term consequences. But as you say, I mean, we may know that within a few years from now. And that really shows an even greater transformation, perhaps by preventing infections with this virus.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So, I mean, we are at a cusp. There are some countries which this winter in 2023 will be starting to introduce the first interventions, and many others, I'm sure, will follow in the years ahead. Particularly with the antibodies, what do you see as a particular risk, something that we need to monitor to see whether they'll continue to work?
Well, I think there is a concern that the virus may actually then evolve under pressure from the antibody if it's very widely used. I mean, I would say that a drawback perhaps of the antibody is that it's going to flood the lungs because it's being given as an injection into the muscle. It won't particularly flood the lining of the lungs, which is where the virus really reproduces and multiplies and from whence it spreads. So RSV is an absolute specialist in the ciliated cells of the respiratory tract. Those are the cells it loves, are those little hair cells which beat and bring the mucus up from the chest. You know, that's really where it reproduces. And the consequences of infection down in the lungs, in the lower respiratory tract, will be prevented very effectively by that antibody. But what that antibody won't do is stop infection getting into the mucosa in the first place. So it may be that the virus is actually going to be under little immunological pressure because it will continue to spread between people in the form of a common cold, but you know, won't be able to go down into the lower part of the respiratory tract and cause such severe disease. I think we'll have to obviously continue to monitor to see whether the circulating virus, which is resistant to these new antibodies, is selected by the immunological pressure. But, you know, and we know that there are strains of the virus out there which are resistant to the antibodies. But we will have to wait and see whether those grow into being a very significant problem, whether we need to then change the approach and develop new antibodies or maybe cocktails of antibodies, which might be even more effective.
And as you said at the beginning, if it's toddlers who are actually largely responsible for spread and they're not getting the antibodies, it's newborns who are, one might imagine that it doesn't put a huge pressure on the virus to evolve into an antibody-resistant strain. But it's going to be very interesting to watch that and to understand. Of course, in the context of COVID-19, we do see that virus evolving under pressure from the immune system, from vaccination and from previous infection to always produce new variants. But maybe with RSV, which doesn't seem so keen on doing that, it may be that it's less of an issue. That the RSV vaccines may not have that problem because they actually have much more different types of antibodies. It's much harder for the virus to fully escape.
Yes, and so those lovely T cells that I studied all those years ago. You know, we've just been doing a study to look at the association between T cells and resistance to infection. And in the older adult cohort we've been looking at, actually T cells are reasonably well predictive. So, you know, I think we shouldn't discard the idea that T cells, particularly cells lying within the mucosa, the so-called resident memory T cells, they could actually have an important role as well. And it could be that vaccines are going to induce some of those T cells. I think particularly if we get live vaccines that we can use, which are attenuated and which can be used as a nasal spray, that could be a very practical way of vaccinating toddlers and preventing them from spreading and infecting other people.
I mean, my sort of memory of this field, though, is that making the viruses weak enough that you could use them as a vaccine tended to make them not very protective. And if you don't weaken them enough, they cause more infection. So it's been quite difficult to get that right with those so far. But that's certainly something, a space to watch for the future. In the near future, we've got the possibility of these new interventions, which could really transform child health and make a big difference also in adult respiratory medicine to keep you happy and keep people out of hospital.
Absolutely.
Peter Openshaw, Professor of Experimental Medicine at Imperial, thank you very much for joining us on this podcast.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you, Andy.
That was the Oxford Colloquy. Thanks for joining us in our podcast, bringing you the facts, stories and people behind the science. So you might be wondering, what is a colloquy? We've called this podcast series the Oxford Colloquy. Well, a colloquy is a discourse or a conversation, and hopefully you'll agree that that's what we've been having.